Okay, so continuing on with issues of sexual selection. So regardless of whether you approach this from Fisher's runaway hypothesis or either of the good genes interpretations, we've got a case where in most species, I mean occasionally there's male choice, but in most species we're dealing with a lot of female choice because peoples are generally the limiting resource here. So the female choice, though, is going to actually influence both future male and female characteristics and traits. So just because you've got one sex selecting from the other, and this applies for humans, because really in humans we've definitely got both male and female choice. But let's just deal with female choice here. So if you've got females selecting particular traits in the opposite sex there to mate with, that will influence then those male characteristics, trait. Now by traits I mean either physiological issues or behavioral. Could be either here. But at the same time, we're also altering the females' perspectives of things. So this works both ways. And it works both ways here due to issues of both intersexual selection and intra. Now, we think of intersexual selection, this would mean typically female choice, right? Males display or do something females pick. But look, females then, let's just deal with humans here, okay? Give you an example. So we'll talk about this later, but waist-to-hip ratio. So the idea that there's a particular waist-to-hip ratio that may be particularly attractive to males, or at least a range of waist-to-hip ratios. Okay, so males are perhaps attracted to, through selective processes, a particular waist-to-hip ratio, but the females know this, right? Women's behavior has shifted and changed as well. Their cognition of this has also evolved. So females know that males are looking for this, they know this, and then they will be competing as well amongst themselves to meet these particular characteristics and traits. So it influences both sexes. So whether we're talking about female choice or male choice, the influences go both ways. Okay. If you will, in the very simple way of looking at this, the male traits get passed on to the sons here, female preferences passed to the daughters, but it goes both ways. This again. Right. Forgot about that. Okay. Let's just turn that off. Okay. Now, a question here. So, again, let's just deal with the male ornamentation here. The sort of, let's just look at it from one side. We can look at it from both. I mean, we could do it from either side here. But again, just in the context of what's traditionally called female choice. Then what is the male ornamentation for? Now, the different interpretations here, Fisher's runaway selection process and the two good genes hypotheses, take somewhat different approaches. The Fisherian approach, the runaway selection approach, just says that the male ornamentation makes males attractive to females. Started as something that was had survival value, and then eventually shifted into a sexual selection process. But basically, the ornamentation is a made you look sort of thing. If you lack it, and you can do this. So, I mean, you can take widow birds and with a pair of scissors, you know, take a very dominant, successful male, cut his tail feathers off, and suddenly the females want nothing to do with him. Superficial? Oh, yes. Shallow? Yes. Evolutionarily valid? No. I mean, you know, you had to wait for your psychologist to wander around with a pair of scissors in the African plains cutting tails off birds. I mean, I don't know. Okay. So, this approach says the ornamentation strictly, you know, however it eventually evolved and got there, once it translates into a sexually selected characteristic, it's an issue of attracting attention, gaining the attention of the opposite sex. The two good genes arguments we looked at, or interpretations, honest signals and parasite resistance, both say that whatever the ornamentation is, it serves as a signal, a phenotypic signal of genetic fitness, so a phenotypic signal of good genotype. So it's not just about attracting attention, being salient, it's actually conveying specific information, which is right. There's actually some support on both sides of this. It sort of depends on the particular species we're dealing with, the particular trait we're dealing with. Okay, so there's some support in both camps. There's probably, I mean, more broadly for the good genes arguments, whether it's honest signals or parasite, there's probably more force of weight on these. But there are cases where we can say, yeah, you know, Fisher's interpretation seems to hold here, all right. But there's good argument for the good genes interpretations here. But again, there's a possibility that the systems are all in operation in different species or under different environmental conditions is an issue. As well, given that you're going to have this back and forth in terms of, if you will, competing evolutions between natural selection and sexual selection, right? And these may be in different points of competition at different times. I mean, from if you think of this in terms of, say, early development of humans, right? Before you pass puberty, there's no point, really, having these sexually selected characteristics. So anything, you know, but anything that may have some sort of future sexual selected characteristic may have some other, I mean, it may attract attention. It may be involved in social issues. So these may fulfill different roles. Then you pass puberty, become sexually active, this shifts into a different context. So there's possibilities here that these traits maybe act on in different ways at different times. So we don't have to sacrifice one theory for the others here. Okay. So we said that gene mutation is just one source of variation in species. We said it's probably not, unless you're an asexually reproducing species, the most important here. What we see in most of the higher animals, and many of the plants for that matter, most of the plants actually, is sexual reproduction, either entirely sexual reproduction, or at least even for things like, you know, worms and snails who are hermaphroditic, in that case they can't self-fertilize. They have to, even being hermaphrodites, they have to mate with another snail. So we see very strong, as evolution worked on the animals, once we really get into the macroscopic animals, the multicellular animals, there starts to be a real push, evolutionary drive, towards sexual reproduction. That being said, there's more species out there that do it asexually. Okay? I mean, there's just so many more little one-celled microbes and bacteria. And so it's asexual reproduction is extremely common. Sometimes called parthenogenesis. Basically, it's a cloning process. And we talked last class about one example, say the Daphnia, the water fleas, that will toggle between asexual and sexual reproduction. So that certainly occurs. Now, you say, okay, so sexual reproduction, great. Why, though? There are costs to sexual reproduction. It's actually expensive in any number of ways. By using meiosis, what you're really doing is you're tossing half of your allelic forms of your genes away with every creation of an organism, right? R value 0.5. You share an R value of 0.5 with any child you produce. Not one. You share an R value of 1 with yourself. So you've just tossed away half of your genetic complement. Next thing that's expensive is producing males. All males are going to successfully reproduce. Pretty much all females will, all other things being equal. And then finally, there's the costs involved in courtship and mating. Even if you go down to the relatively, the lower vertebrates, certain fish, for example, they still have courtship rituals, fish dancing, holding territory, providing food resources to attract mates. That's expensive. So we're going to take a look at these. So meiosis here. Consider the case of an asexually reproducing happy organism here. Okay, it's a little single cell organism, I guess, or whatever. It reproduces asexually. So our mother organism here basically asexually reproduces and produces two offspring. Now, each of the offspring, barring any gene mutations, but again, that's relatively small number there, for all intents and purposes, these two offspring are basically identical to the mother organism. Okay? They then each produce two offspring through asexual reproduction, and again, barring any minor gene mutations, some nucleotide polymorphisms, they're going to be the same as their mother, who was the same as her mother. And so, really, after only two generations, you know, this one organism now got four copies of her genome out there. Obviously, things could eat some of these, they could die in other ways, but in our little sort of platonic world of ideal conditions, you know, after only two generations, you know, we've got four copies of your genome kicking about in the world. So a full set of your genes gets passed on to each and every offspring. Consider meiosis, on the other hand. In meiotic systems, by producing gametes, you tear your genome in half. Half gets packaged into one egg, it goes into another egg, or one sperm, another sperm. And then it's got to get together with the gamete from some other member of your species and put it back together here. So in each generation, so, you know, the parent here passes half of the genome on, and then this one here passes half of his or her genome on. So a half set gets passed to each offspring. So you might say, okay, we'll have to... And now, it's even worse, if you will, because let's go back to our original here. So this top one passes half of the genome on, and then half of this one's gets passed, so really only a quarter. So after two generations, we've only got, let's see, well, a quarter plus a quarter plus a quarter plus a quarter, we've only got one copy of complement of our progenitor's genome out here, whereas in the asexual, you got four copies. So meiosis is expensive. It's costly. You can pass your complete sets of genes on much more readily and easily through asexual reproduction. With respect to producing males, all other things being equal, practically all females will find some male to mate with. Maybe not the best quality male, maybe not the highest caliber male, but some male. Therefore, pretty much every female can produce offspring. Keep that in mind, because we will come back to this when we start talking about later social systems and parenting and things like this. In most species of sexually reproducing vertebrates, and also in many cultures of humans, a minority of males will reproduce. Well, in humans, it's perhaps not a minority of males, but if you look at the other mammals, in pretty much all mammal species, a few exceptions, it's a small minority of males that ever get the chance to reproduce. Humans, this isn't quite as skewed, probably because of the necessity for pair bonding, putting a certain huge amount of energy into raising offspring, so we're a little more balanced, but definitely still. For example, in cultures that practice polygamy, some males will have multiple wives, many males will have only one wife, and some males will have no wives. If some have many, some are going to have none. It's just the way it balances out. Okay? So, if you're a sexually reproducing species, by producing males, and I mean, think about this in something that's not a human, right? Even, let's even pick a primate. If you're Geldon baboon, only the most dominant males usually get a chance to mate. So if you're producing sons, odds are most of your sons are not going to reproduce. They're a genetic dead end. You produce a daughter, the most dominant male there is going to reproduce with her, or some male will, at least. So this is kind of a waste of resources. Why should you expend resources on an offspring that's probably not going to increase your long-term differential reproductive success? Finally, courtship costs and mating itself. This is going to be extremely time and energy expensive. It might involve lots of foraging, establishing, maintaining territory. All the time you're doing this, you've got to also be avoiding predators. In some species, actually, the male becomes the courtship gift and gets eaten in the process. Mantids, certain mantids will do that. Certain spiders, this would be the case. I mean, black widows. Males aren't trying to be eaten by the female, but it happens quite often. So it doesn't usually happen with humans that way, which I guess is a nice thing, but but still, courtship and mating is expensive. It's much less expensive just to clone yourself, asexually reproduce. So, we've got a lot of costs associated with sexual reproduction, but most multicellular species still do it. Why? Becomes the question. From an evolutionary perspective, what's the benefit here? Why is this adaptive? This is puzzling for a long time. Fisher, good old Fisher, same guy with the runaway selection here, 1958, suggested that, well, obviously sexually reproducing species are going to have more variability. By mixing together half of the genetic complement from mom and half from dad, you're going to get higher variability, genotypic variability in the offspring. Now, his argument was that in a rapidly changing environment, this could allow evolutionary forces to act much more quickly on a species. Okay, my Fisher's still working back in a time when greater goodism or species-level evolution was seen as explaining things like altruism and whatnot. So he tends to talk about this at the level of a species, not down at the level of the individuals, but mentally you can translate this down as what's good for a species would also be good for an individual in this case. So in the case of a rapidly changing environment, it says if you've got a sexually reproducing species, you keep mixing it up enormously each and every generation so that at least some of your of the next generation are going to be having traits that will allow them to be better adapted to the environment. So it allows evolution, he says, allows evolution to act much more rapidly. If you have an asexually reproducing species, they have to rely on mutation, individual gene mutation, to put that variation in. And again, most gene mutations are probably going to be fatal. So, well, either do nothing or be fatal. There's going to be a very small minority that actually are going to confer any advantage. So it's going to be the evolutionary pressure is going to be slower. Now, most asexually reproducing species get around this by having extremely short generation spans. But as you start getting into multicellular organisms, the generation times, the generations become longer and longer. Okay. Mueller, 1964, concept called Mueller's Ratchet. He said, Mueller said harmful evolution, the harmful mutations that evolve in an asexual individual will then be passed on to all offspring. So if you've got a parent organism who's got some harmful mutation, it's perhaps not fatally harmful, but it, you know, it costs whatever, a certain amount. There's a cost to it, right? Like a 1% cost to overall energy budget. It says, well, assuming that organism can actually still survive long enough to asexually reproduce, that deficit will then be passed on to all of the offspring, all of the asexually produced offspring, who will then pass it on to their offspring, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, because every generation that has mutations stands a more likely chance of having something that is maladaptive than adaptive, there's more ways to get it wrong than to get it right, Mueller argues that these harmful mutations will just keep building up with each generation. This is what he means a ratchet. I don't know if you ever know, if you know what a ratchet is, but think of a gear that's got a little sprocket that holds it. So as you turn the gear, a little sprocket snaps down and holds it in place. In other words, a ratchet is something that only goes in one direction. It can't be reversed. So you ratchet something up. You ratchet the tension up on a tool or something like that. So that's what he means by a ratchet. So these harmful mutations will continue to accumulate in the population. Now he says, in sexual reproduction, only half the offspring, unless you happen to have a particularly severe mutation that affects that comes in from both parents, right, only half of the offspring are going to acquire one of these harmful mutations from a parent. So if dad has a harmful mutation, well, only half of the sperm are going to be carrying that allelic form of it, so only half of the offspring are likely to carry a copy of this. And given that individuals that then have that harmful mutation are perhaps more less likely to actually find mates, right, because you need somebody else to sexually reproduce with, whereas an asexual species just has to acquire enough energy to actually do this themselves. In this case, again, here's another block on passing these harmful mutations along. So in two ways, these mutations are going to be reduced across generations. So Mueller argued that sexual reproduction actually reduces or limits the spread of deleterious mutations in the gene pool. Now again, as I said, Fisher, certainly, and Mueller as well, they're both operating in time really before biological theorists, evolutionary theorists, were thinking about individuals at the level of selection. So they're looking at this from species levels or population levels. So they're dealing with a group level selection here. Okay. You can take much of what they argued and kind of recast it down to the individual in terms of, say, kinship lines. But still, just keep that in mind. More recently, though, we focus on the individual. So, Williams, 75, says that each offspring is like a raffle ticket or a lottery ticket. It says in a sexually reproducing species, each ticket, that is, offspring, is different. So if you play the lotto, this is like getting a bunch of tickets, but they're all different numbers. In an asexual species, this is playing the lotto where every one of your offspring is the same number. Now, if you're the sexually reproducing species, if you win, you know, maybe one of your 10 offspring tickets wins. If you're the asexual reproducing species and you win, all, let's say, 10 of your offspring tickets win. So it becomes a trade-off. Win big, or how do you want to do this? Do you want to put it all on red 24, or do you want to spread it out on the roulette table? Playing the odds, what do you want to do? Well, William says it really comes down to the environmental issue of environmental stability. If the environment is stable, then if you are, as an asexual reproducing species, if you are successful, in other words, you're a winning ticket, okay, then if you produce offspring that are just like you, they'll be winning tickets as well, as long as the environment's stable. If the environment changes, though, sexually reproducing species have a real advantage. You're hedging your bets. Okay? You can't guarantee that the next generation's environment is going to be exactly the same as your own. You may not be a winning ticket. You may need to change it up a bit. Maybe not too much. Sexual reproduction does is change it a bit, but not a gigantic amount in each generation. Okay? So Williams is saying in situations where we're going to have more variable environments. And if we think about this, as we get into multicellular organisms, they tend to live longer. They tend to be able to move around further, get about more. But even just having a longer lifespan tends to mean that, yeah, there's a greater chance that your environment is going to shift, even if it's seasonal, right? Going from spring into summer. If you're a fruit fly the first fruit flies that hatch out in the spring, 3-4 weeks later, you can have the next generation there, but they're going to perhaps be into late spring or summer. So being able to mix it up works. If you're an asexually reproducing bacteria, 8 hours later is the next generation, and frankly, that's still part of perhaps the same day, so nothing's really changed all that much. Tomorrow's probably going to be more or less the same as today from that perspective. I can imagine, old bacteria, you know, bacteria. It's like, ah, in my day it was spring. Ah, you bacteria today on about summer is good. No, nobody else thinks that's okay. All right. Tangled Bank. I got to mention this one because your textbook talks about it, but I was going to say, don't worry about Tangled Bank too much. There's, well, okay. Let's go with my version of it as opposed to what the textbook drags in. Bell, Canadian Connection. Bell was at, he was out of Montreal. So, 1982, Bell comes out with this massively thick and nearly impenetrably written book on Tangled Bank. I suspect that the reason that the authors include it in the textbook is somebody forced them to read it as an undergrad or graduate student, and it was so hideous that they feel they have to actually reference it and deal with it because they were forced to. I don't know exactly, but so Bell, the part of the problem with this is the book is just very hard to read. It's not written in the most clear style. Bell says, look, based on evidence, empirical observations, data he collected, he says that actually you find more sexually reproducing species in stable environments than unstable environments. So he says, if you look at things like oceans or low altitudes as opposed to high altitudes, he says, compared to land mass, an ocean is more stable, right? I mean, there's a massive amount of water in the ocean, so in terms of like thermal stability, it's huge. You can't have, I mean, here in Edmonton, we can have the temperature go from minus 20 to plus 20 in one day. That can't happen in the ocean. It just doesn't work. It won't happen. So Bell argues, look, if we take a look at this, we actually find more sexually reproducing species in these stable environments. So the raffle theory predictions that sexual reproduction goes because of unstable environments seems to be a problem here. Now, Bell said, but the issue here really comes into what are we talking about in terms of stability and instability or changing. He said, if you only think about the physical environment, then sure, the ocean is much more stable. But if you start thinking about the environment as not just the physical nature, the elevation, the temperature, the size of the body of water, whatnot, but you also think about the living things that are in there, the biotic factors, then that kind of changes the picture. He says the raffle theory is only thinking about this in terms of the physicality. We need to think about the other biology. Because really, you know, when we talk about, you know, organisms, you know, what adapts you best to the environment, most people think about the physical environment, but that environment's filled up with a lot of other critters, some of which are members of your own species, some are members of other species. But you're also, they're all trying to survive, you're trying to survive. It's a great big world of competition out there. And this is where he comes up with the term tangled bank. There's a little line on The Origin of Species where Darwin sort of waxes on poetic about this bank and how, you know, it's tangled with overgrowth and every plant is fighting with every other plant to get its little bit of the soil and water and all of this. And so we've got this massive tangled growth that evolution is happening on. Competition is visceral and real. So anyways, that's why Bell calls it the Tangled Bank Theory. Now, looking at this, Bell says, if you've got a stable abiotic environment, okay, so just no biology involved here, this is predictable, but it's a less severe environment. So we've got lots of benefits to the individual, but there's also benefits to your competitors. Now, Bell argues that the greatest competition you're ever going to encounter, the greatest competitors for you are other members of your own species, right? Okay, we're not graded on a curve, so my example is about not to work. Imagine you're in a course that's graded on a curve. Who are you competing with? Well, other members of your own species, right? I mean, you know, the fly that's gotten into the room isn't in competition with you for that one. Right? Your bacteria that are living in, you know, eyebrow mites, you know, it's like, yeah, if we get the A, we score. It's like, it's other members of your species. So, they need the same resources. Somebody else says, yeah, this is where your competition comes from. This is why the biotic environment really mixes this up. So even though you've got a stable abiotic environment like the ocean, but that lets you have lots and lots of members of your own species in that area. And that's really who you're dealing with. He says, so the physical environment then shuffles down to maybe a secondary level because it's pretty much equal for everybody. But in that case, you've got lots and lots of competition coming in for other members of your own species and other species for that matter. And so any small variation that you might have that your offspring gain through sexual reproduction, that could give just that little bit of edge. Just a little bit of edge that makes you just a little bit more successful than your competitors. Because that's how evolution works, small edges. Okay, so that's Bell. Probably the most predominant recent theory about sexual selection or sexual reproduction versus asexual is kind of called the Red Queen Hypothesis. And it goes back to a line from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, where Alice meets up with the Red Queen, and the Red Queen says something like, well, Alice, it takes all the running you can do just to keep in the same place. And Alice says, well, that's very funny, because where I come from, if you run, you actually go someplace else. So the Queen is telling her here through the looking glass, you've got to run as fast and as hard as you can just to stay in place. Imagine that you're running on a conveyor belt. If you stop running, you'll be shooting off the back end. Now, this originally actually goes back to Van Valen from 73, who generated this interpretation. It's been much more recently promoted by people like Matt Ridley. Matt Ridley is a biologist, but he's over the last about 15 years turned his hand to writing popular science books. Excellent. Pick up anything by Matt Ridley and read it. Excellent writer, and spends a lot of time writing specifically about evolutionary theory, biology, genetics. So, very, very nice. But I do recommend his books there. So, but Van Valen said, okay, look, here's what's happening. You've got an arms race going on between parasites and the hosts, and it's an ongoing arms race. Parasites have short lifespans, high rates of reproduction. They tend to often be asexual reproducers, but not always. But parasites tend to have short lifespans and come in large numbers. Parasites are smaller than their hosts. Right? I can't think of really any cases where you have a parasite that's larger than its host species. If you can think of one, let me know. I can't come up with one. Parasites tend, I think, as far as I can think of, are always smaller than their hosts. Okay? If you've got something that's larger than the host, that's probably called a predator, and it just eats the host. We call that predation. So parasites are smaller there. But because they get a lot of parasites in the host, this means it lets them evolve at a much more rapid rate. The hosts. The hosts tend to live longer, their reproduction rates are slower, so you can get multiple generations of parasites within the same lifespan of the host. If the parasites have found a host for which they are, you know, the parasites are just nailing that host, the host has poor resistance to the parasites. This is a big score for the parasites. Sucks to be the host. Now, if the host reproduces asexually, all of its offspring are going to be equally susceptible to the parasites. But if the host mixes it up through sexual reproduction, there's going to be a lot of variation by necessity put into the offspring. Yeah, some of the offspring are going to still be susceptible to the parasites, but some probably won't. Some, in fact, will be partially resistant. Some may be extremely resistant. But at the minimum here, there's probably going to at least be some that are at least partially resistant to the parasites. Now the parasites, again, so now you got parasites in this partially resistant next generation host. These parasites aren't doing as well, so they're not going to be as successful at even asexually reproducing. But again, because their generations are short, because they can asexually reproduce a lot, they'll go through a whole bunch of generations, and eventually through random genetic mutation, typically, stumble upon some new characteristic or trait that allows them to be better at parasitizing this host. Perhaps by this point, the host has reproduced, again, mixes up the genetics there through sexual reproduction, ends up with some offspring that are resistant to the parasites, and on and on and on it goes. So hosts evolve resistances to the parasites, then the parasites evolve ways to counter those resistances. So this goes back to the arms race, right? The concept popularized in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s with the United States and the Soviet Union. One comes up with a new missile system, one comes up with a counter to that missile system, then a counter and a counter and a counter, and back and forth and back and forth. So it's actually been suggested that, you know, this may explain in some cases why, if you look through the fossil record, you sometimes see over periods of time characteristics that had evolved in the past sort of reoccur in the future. And sometimes it's a little puzzling, but it's been suggested that these may be involved in this. So over many, many, many generations, you know, this is all cycled around. So something that was useful for resisting parasites in the past, and parasites eventually develop a counter for it, which leads off to a whole series of new counters being evolved in the hosts, but eventually we cycle around and that original counter comes back in. So if we stopped using antibiotics, for example, entirely stopped them now, and let generations of bacteria reproduce, and, you know, they brought antibiotics in back in 100 years, we may find that we've got relatively few antibiotic-resistant bacteria left, since there's not that pressure in the environment, there's no selection in favor of it. Over, I remember we said something like 300,000 generations of bacteria occur in 25 years, so, you know, we've got over, you know, well over a million generations of bacteria there. They may simply, you know, lose that level of antibiotic resistance, which means antibiotics come back in as being useful. I don't think that's likely to happen as we start sticking antibiotics in everything in sight. Counter cleaners, you don't need antibiotics to clean your counter. Use bleach. Use soap. Just soap. Or fire. The downside with that one, but still, guys like the idea, you know? Seriously, if guys could clean the counter in the kitchen with fire, you'd have a lot more men cleaning up in the kitchen. Probably need to make our counters out of stainless steel and our houses out of concrete. Still. Okay, so, Lively, 1987. Nice little test of Red Queen hypothesis here in particular. Okay, here's, remember I mentioned Bell's Tangled Bank Theory. If you've read the textbook, you will find that the authors of your textbook use Lively's study of New Zealand steel, New Zealand snails to try to distinguish between Tangled Bank and the Red Queen hypothesis. I've never been able to figure out exactly what the authors of the textbook are trying to do here. Because I've read Lively's papers, and he only mentions Tangled Bank once in extreme passing. His paper's really not about that at all. So I did email the textbook authors a couple of years ago about this and never heard what the rationale was. This. So frankly, my advice to you is, you've read this little, you know, there's a couple of pages there, just ignore the way your textbook talks about this as a test between Tangled Bank and the Red Queen hypothesis. I'll sort of tell you what was going on here, and we can move on from there, shall we? Good. So, New Zealand water snails. These New Zealand water snails can either reproduce asexually or sexually, depending upon environmental conditions. They also exist in a variety of environments. They exist both in stable, relatively stable lakes, and unstable streams. Right in the lake, it's a big mass of water. You have to perturb it an awful lot to change temperatures or environmental toxins or all this. Streams, stuff comes washing through it. I mean, if someone spills some chemicals upstream, next day it's downstream washing over the snails in high concentrations. Okay. Now, Red Queen Hypothesis says that you would expect to see sexual reproduction in the lakes and asexual reproduction in the streams. Why? Because the stable lakes are going to result in a high number of parasites. This is, in fact, what we find. By having a large environment there, where it's relatively stable, if you've got a successful parasite, you can get lots of successful parasites very, very quickly. And they can build up. Things build up and build up and build up, whereas in streams they may get washed away and vanish. So, in fact, we do find this. So we find higher sexual reproduction in the snails. We've also got a higher count of snail parasites in the lake. These go together. Okay, so there is good support for the Red Queen Hypothesis. And this has really become kind of the predominant view, or at least an extremely strong view, I should say, on how sexual reproduction began. Way back in time, probably likely due to parasites. Now, let's see, what am I talking about here? Oh, yeah. Right, so switching off of sort of theory about sexual reproduction, let's talk just a little bit here about how sexual selection may have had some interesting influences on a behavioral attribute of ancestral humans. So, as I've said before, if we go back about 4 or 5 million years ago, our ancestors started progressing in from an arboreal, brachiating form of locomotion, predominantly quadrupedal if they were come down onto land. They start evolving into a bipedal form of locomotion. The posture starts to shift upright. They start getting better at walking on the hind two legs. And then over time, this leads to a variety of other adaptations. So reduced body hair, this lets us cool more effectively. Increased sweat glands. Body hair actually interferes with cooling. If you've got the hair there, it's breaking up the amount of breeze it's blowing over you. This reduces evaporation. We have a relatively high proportion of sweat glands pretty much all over our body. Why? Probably because we need the cooling. We move around, as primates, we move around an inordinate amount. Most other primates, I mean, you'll see primates move around quickly and do things, swing from a tree, jump from a branch, but tend to be stationary a lot of the time, and they don't tend to be doing, they may move quickly, but they don't tend to be doing endurance movement. Humans, as bipedal, we can just keep going and going and going. As long as we don't overheat, we can keep going for a very long time. Most other primates don't keep moving. I mean, if you had to force march a band of monkeys, I mean, you have a bunch of really unhappy monkeys. Right? We're gonna stop doing that. All right. So, all of these characteristics make our ancestors better adapted for covering distances, long distances. A couple million years after this, after our bipedalism really starts going, after we've gone down that path, after we sort of burned the bridges of returning to being quadrupeds, the brain size of our ancestors starts going up. And some estimates suggest that we gain about 150 million brain cells every 100,000 years. Not bad. But neural tissue is expensive. Stunningly expensive. You need to fuel your nervous system. You need very specific things as well. You need things like oils, fats, proteins. You don't have those, you don't have a big central nervous system. We start also getting increases in the size of our ancestors. Okay, so we start getting larger. In terms of height, we're pretty tall for primates. Yeah, I mean, gorillas outmass us, but really, aside from gorillas, we're the biggest primates there pretty much are, on average. We're bigger than chimpanzees. Less massive than gorillas, but very different environments there. The Nariokotomi boy skeleton from 1.6 million years ago. Actually, if he'd survived to be an adult, probably died at about the age of 14 or so. If he'd survived to be an adult, estimates say that he probably would have been almost 6 feet tall. So going back 1.6 million years ago, you always see these, the evolution of humans where, it sort of starts with a chimpanzee and gradually gets more upright until you've got, man with spear walking erect and proud. Well, and everyone else is hunched over and short in the past. Okay. Well, I mean, even going back 1.6 million years, our ancestors can be pretty tall. Oh, sure, you go back to Australopithecines, you go back to the Homo habilis, yeah, definitely shorter in stature there. But by the time we're within the last 1.5 to 2 million years, basically our ancestors looked not too dissimilar from us. Pretty similar. You'd be hard-pressed to go, I don't think that's a member of my ancestral species. That must be a totally random difference. It's like, yeah, we're related somehow. Okay. Other thing that happens is females start getting, well, either females start getting larger relative to males or males start getting smaller relative to females. So we don't have these extreme dimorphisms, physical side dimorphisms. So we've got a bunch of physical things happening here. Brain's getting bigger, we're becoming more upright, we're doing better at distance travel, we're getting taller, the differences were, in terms of the size between males and females are being reduced. These are all physical changes. But possibility here is that they're being driven by sexual selection. So these can be driven through sexual selection processes. Now, chimpanzees are basically promiscuous. Male and female chimpanzees do not pair bond. When a female chimpanzee, common chimpanzee, goes into heat, all of the males that are able will try to mate with her. For the bonobo chimpanzees, it's the same thing, but they'll be having sex any old day of the week just because they're bonobos. That's the way they roll. But basically, both of the chimpanzee species that currently exist are promiscuous. They do not pair bond. Gorillas follow a harem polygyny style. So the most dominant male will mate with all of the females in the troop. And then as this male gets older, usually one of the next oldest males replaces him as the dominant male and takes over. Of the other great apes, the orangutans, also, they don't pair bond. Males only get together with females long enough to mate, and then they take off, and that male will try to mate with multiple females in territories that overlap his own. So greater differences in size and body size correlate, when we look at mammals, with polygyny. Reduction in sexual size dimorphism, more monogamous. As brain size started, so we shifted into a bipedal structure. Then the brain started to get larger. We talked about the problems of trying to actually birth babies with large brains. So that leads to difficulties. Consequently, there's a pressure here on this. We have to give birth a bit early. The infants are more helpless. They need support. It becomes more important now for our ancestors, both males and females, to become choosier. Chimpanzees are not all that choosy, okay? I mean, females would try to, females will try to mate with the more dominant males, but I mean, frankly, all the males are trying to mate with the female, okay? Given that the male's not really going to help her at all raising the offspring, as long as she can mate with a somewhat good male, it's all coming down to her anyways. But our ancestors here, certainly probably by the mid Homo erectus period, females had to start looking for males who were going to contribute. Males that are likely to actually bring resources back to assist her in rearing the young. And males, conversely, have to start being pickier about what females, not just any female, but ones that are perhaps actually going to be good at long-term child rearing. Ones that are likely to survive childbirth. Ones that may be patient, good mothers. These sorts of issues. Stable. Okay. So we've got things happening here. As well, because this really puts a limitation on the number of, by drawing out the development of the child longer, this really limits the number of offspring a female can have. So males also start probably looking for younger females. So trying to get access to particularly young females to mate with. Females start looking for providers. This perhaps starts driving a division in labor. Males go off and hunt. Why do we need males to go off and hunt? Well, males, remember we talked about the central nervous system needs oils, fats, proteins. Where do you get those? Tofu! No. Well, yes, but, I mean, no tofu stands in the Serengeti, okay? How do you get it? You kill something and eat it. So, hunting. And if we take a look at the development of tools in the archaeological record, we find that our ancestors started to get pretty good at making tools for killing other things. So males have to go out and bring back meats. Meats have, animals have fats, animals have proteins. Chimpanzees will do this too. Chimpanzee males that manage to kill a squirrel or antelope or something, we'll drag that back and they'll share the meat out with the females. They'll preferentially share that meat out with the females. And then when the female, when the females that receive meat from a male go into heat, she's more likely to mate with the male that gave her meat in the past. I'm not saying it's the only male she'll mate with, but makes that male look better. Now, the male's not helping her raise any baby chimps after that. So these courtship, pre-courtship gifts, if you will, at least predispose the female to consider this male for more favorably for mating when she goes into estrus. But in humans, given the long-term need for parental care here, this could drag this out. So males go off. They have to bring back the meat. It's necessary not just for before the female gives birth, but for the development, proper development of the CNS of the child. Protein and fat malnutrition leads to all in infants leads to all kinds of neural difficulties and deficits. Okay? If the males weren't doing this, the female would have to do this, both during her pregnancy, which we think progressively got longer, and then after she's given birth. Now, try to visualize hunting an antelope while carrying an infant. What's the other choice? Leave the infant someplace by itself and go hunt the antelope. You leave your infant behind someplace, and what is it? It's snack food for a predator. Doesn't work. What's the solution? Division of labor. So females start looking for males that will be good providers. Those males that become good providers produce more offspring because their offspring aren't going to be left alone, abandoned, picked off by predators. Their offspring aren't going to be malnourished. Their offspring will have better developed central nervous systems due to access to fats and proteins that are necessary at particular developmental points. Those offspring then, again, carry on the males, carry on the characteristics of fathers that had them. The females carry on the preferences for the mother. If you will, it sort of ramps up. Now, here's the other thing. You also do need plant food. We're not carnivores. We are omnivores. We get all sorts of essential vitamins and other things out of plants. But that's the sort of thing that females can actually gather either while pregnant or while they've got small children. In fact, after children get to be a few years old, the children can help with the gathering. So now males are also looking for females that are going to be good at providing plant-based materials, necessary plants, and probably going to be behaviorally well-suited to raising the young and having the young help, it becomes a reciprocal arrangement. So the sexual selection processes, perhaps originally driven by evolution into bipedalism for whatever reason, lead to then changes in our behavior, making us extremely, well, not totally unique, but pretty unique when it comes to primate methods for raising young. It's a bit of a feedback cascade, if you will. Large brains need meat. Food sharing allowed our ancestors to increase the amount of meat in the diet. Okay? So the food sharing, but the food sharing also demands bigger brains. You need to know who shared food with you in the past, who's cheated you in the past, who's a freeloader in your group, who should you share with in the future, who should you not share with in the future. So the bigger the brain, the better at cognition you are, the better you are at playing that food sharing game. Larger brains also then allow sort of formalization of the rules for division of labor. This is another reason why I tend to, my personal feeling is that at least simple forms of language-based communication probably go back quite a ways. I don't think language is like 90,000 years old. I think it's much older than that. Because as soon as you can start formalizing divisions of labor in some way, then that requires some form of metacognition. Larger brains that were driving this, okay? So the sexual division of labor then starts promoting monogamy, moving away from a polygamous structure. If you will, a pair-bonded unit becomes a good economic system. The cost benefits pan out. It doesn't mean that it has to be particularly long-term pair bonding, right? Serial monogamy, not uncommon in humans, right? If males are successful enough in providing resources, sure. Perhaps they acquire a second mate. But they've got to be good enough at it. The environment has to be rich enough. They have to be strong. Something has to allow them to be able to provide enough resources there. Okay. Monogamy leads to things like neotenous sexual selection, that is looking for youthful characteristics, females by males, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So starting perhaps from some evolutionary adjustments on the physical structure of our ancestors, we can at least hypothesize. Now, to be fair, I'm giving you a little bit of a just-so story. We don't know all of these details. We do know things about when the brain size starts to increase. We do know how expensive brain tissue is. We do know that brain tissue requires oils and fats and proteins. We do know when our ancestors got better at making tools for hunting. So we have facts on all of that. But exactly the whens and hows of this with sexual reproduction, that doesn't fossilize. But this is at least a fairly plausible interpretation that fits with the physical evidence that we do have. So there's a little bit of a just-so story. All the details may not quite be right, but may not be too far off. So we can see how sexual selection can actually have very strong repercussions on modifying some very complicated human behaviors. Let us progress on to chapter 4, and we're going to talk here about human mate choice. So some fun stuff. All right, now, in the cases of humans and a few other species of animals, but primarily humans here, at least within the mammals, when looking for a mate, humans are looking for genes and parenting abilities. It's twofold. Most species, it's just the genes that you're looking for, good genetics. In humans, we need both. Now, when evolutionary psychologists approach issues of mate choice and mate selection, they tend to do this by looking for what we call underlying universals. So, sure, one person prefers blondes, another person prefers redheads. Somebody wants a partner that's tall, another wants a partner that's short. Okay, there are always individual differences. what evolutionary psychologists look for are the things that tend to, if you look at a large group of individuals, you look for the predominant things. So, generally speaking, males find, male preferences are for a mate that's a few years younger than they are, and women, female preferences are for a male that's a few years older. My wife is younger than I am, by about 11 years. 9 years. On the flip side, she's taller than I am. Generally find that males find shorter. So, I mean, you know, it's like, okay, so on one hand, yeah, I follow the population average. On the other hand, it's like, well, that happened there. Okay, so this thing, there's always individual differences, okay? But an evolutionary psychologist, and you go, so what about that evolutionary psychologist? Like, it's a learning thing or a random thing. But overall, I can say this is, you know, there's always a distribution of traits within a population. Evolutionary psychologists tend to look for the big things. So, keep that in mind. You might say, but that doesn't apply to me, or I do it differently. Yeah, you might. Or you might say, oh yeah, I've done that. Okay. We're looking at the populations. Okay. Yes, the individual is the level of selection within the population, but when we're finding these characteristics, we find them by looking at, by taking a larger sample size. Right? Okay. So here's, again, a few of these sorts of things. We tend to find that compared to many other species, both males and females are choosier about their partners than in many other species, but generally speaking, females are choosier than males. Okay, going back to Trivor's parental investment, this fits. The females, by necessity, by biology, it's not a patriarchal system putting women down, it's the biology, sorry. So their investment costs are higher. Reproduction is more costly for females. They need to put greater emphasis on child support. Okay? Males may be more choosy than many of our other primate relatives. We're less choosy, typically, than females. If you look at personal ads, if you look at psychology studies of personal ads, they're kind of fun to do these. I think the earliest psychology study of personal ads came from about 1927 that was looking at personal ads running in a Yiddish newspaper in Warsaw, I think was the earliest one I ever found. But if you look at, and there's since then, there's been hundreds of studies, psychology studies done on personal ads. If you look at these studies, you will find that in personal ads, and personal ads provide a wealth of information about mate choice, you find that the women have a whole criteria of things that they are looking for, many characteristics, looking for as this and that and this other thing, and oh, a good sense of humor, oh, and a good earner, and good chill, and that, and the other thing. It's a list. Or ask any woman what she's looking for, and you will probably get a nicely itemized list. You ask males, it's like, honestly, pretty would be nice, smells good. He has a good sense of humor. Did I mention pretty? Maybe longer, but you know, males don't tend to itemize their lists as well. And certainly if you look in personal ad data on that, very different. It jumps up pretty quickly. Okay. Males have a lower reproductive cost. Right. I mean, at minimum, it's some sperm. You might say, wait a minute, but the male has to provide for the offspring. He's like, well, I mean, maybe ideally, but not necessarily. Doesn't always. Take a look at, say, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example. Just to randomly pick somebody out of the news currently. You do know what I'm talking about, right? Okay, Schwarzenegger just came out. His wife and he are separated because he had a love child over a decade ago. Right? Okay. He wasn't investing heavily into this and this other child. Produced offspring, didn't have to invest too much in it. There you go. So males, and again, this is a generality, and be very careful. I mean, some books will say it is adaptive for males to try to produce as many offspring as possible. That's not quite true. It depends extremely heavily upon the particular environment. In some environments, that may be the ideal way to go. In other environments, that may be absolutely the wrong way to go. But generally speaking, we can say that males will place a greater emphasis on securing matings than females will. That is, having more partners than females. The reproductive costs are lower. The other very important thing here to, or a way of contextualizing this, important way of thinking about this, is what's called the interbirth interval. So the interbirth interval for males is basically the amount of time it takes between having one ejaculation until they can have the next, assuming there's a line of women waiting to be impregnated. Big assumption, right? Okay. For females, once the egg gets fertilized, they got 40 weeks of gestation. Once they actually give birth, lactation, nursing, tends to reduce ovulation, if not actually entirely shut it down, for anywhere up to maybe about 16 months. So we've got almost 2.5 years here. If you've got women, and ancestrally, that's how women fed the young, not through formula, was by nursing. And so nursing actually reduces ovulation. So in this sense, we've probably got, at least at minimum, the interbirth interval for females is 40 weeks plus, frankly, it's going to take a while to heal up after giving birth. So, you know, someone aren't looking to have sex right after giving birth, kind of painful. So let's say, a year. Maybe 50 weeks. Okay. So at minimum, and assuming that they start ovulating again pretty quickly, which is unusual, at minimum, you've probably got about a year for interbirth interval for females, whereas you've got something measured in, hypothetically, hours for males. More practically, the female interbirth interval, especially ancestrally, would have been more like, say, minimum 2.5 years. And if we actually look at peoples in either hunter-gatherer groups or non-industrialized nations, we find that the interbirth interval is often between, on average, 3 and 4 years. So, again, the costs here as well is much higher. All right. So, as I said before, sometimes you find textbooks that say males try to have as many children as possible. Females try to focus their efforts on having fewer offspring. So sometimes this is described as males are adapted to produce quantity. So males are looking for quantity, lots, whereas females are looking for quality in offspring. This is, as I said, a gross overgeneralization. In terms of male parenting investment, so in other words, situations, should a male invest in the young? It really comes down to this question. Can the male's investment actually improve the female's rearing success? That is, by investing in the female and the young, does this actually make it more likely that the offspring is going to survive, do better, be more successful at reproduction itself? If the answer is yes, then selective forces will favor males that help with rearing the young. If the answer is no, then selection is going to favor males that have many matings and thereby invest less resources into each. Now, what determines that? Well, it's going to be the environment. It's going to be environmental conditions that are going to determine whether or not the male's investment is useful. If you've got a stunningly rich environment, right? If like meatsicles and stuff just hang on the trees and cakes are plentiful and the temperature is balmy and there's no predators and it's just like that happy, happy dream place,
Eagles probably don't really need males. I mean, they can probably walk over to the meatsicle tree and get their own, you know, fats and oils and proteins and the cake plant, all of that. They can leave their infant securely knowing there's no predators. We're that kind of hypothetical. That's an extreme hypothetical, right? But if we're in an environment where the resources are so plentiful that females can supply them on their own. Okay, if you're Madonna, all right? If you're Madonna, do you really need a male to help you raise your young? No, seriously, you hire child support for that. Once you got the good genes, so I mean, you know, Madonna, you know, had kid with her, like, fitness instructor. Buff, studly fitness instructor. Doesn't need him for resources, right? It's like, thank you, that was great, I've got the baby, now go away. Canada, we're finding women in their successful business women in their 30s to 40s wanting to have children. They're not looking to get married, they're just looking for sperm. Why? They're successful from business. They don't need the male to pay for things. They're good. So in developed countries, we are seeing a very interesting thing happening. We're seeing an increase in single mothers that come out of a particular economic class. So the women that put off reproduction for career, and want to have the children, but they don't need the male. Ancestrally, that didn't happen. Right? Okay? But if you're in an environment where, you know, and there's other ways to go with this as well. I mean, think, what if the environment is so incredibly terrible? Such that the male has basically no resources to spend, you know. What should the male do then? Well, do you have any resources that can actually be invested into making this offspring's survival chances greater or less? At that point, maybe you just say, try to have as many offspring as possible. Hopefully at least one of them makes it. Kind of the bunny rabbit approach to things. Okay, so think about that. Think about that a little bit. Okay, so the quality and quantity. Quality, when we talk about quality here in textbooks and articles, well, quality means you have fewer offspring, but of a higher caliber. Quantity means you have more offspring, but each is of a lower caliber. Now, lower caliber may mean health of the individual. It may mean resources. So if you have fewer offspring, and say in Western environment, everyone's generally fairly healthy, but by having fewer offspring, you can perhaps provide each with a larger inheritance. You know, or if you have fewer offspring, pay for university for all of your kids, or you get the idea. So the higher caliber here, again, we have to tie this to the environment. Right, so we talked about this, quantity versus quality. Right. Ultimately, this all comes down to differential reproductive success. And this is the thing that makes humans so much different from pretty much all the other species, is we've colonized so many radically different environments. Okay, we don't exist in a narrow environmental niche. The only thing we haven't colonized really is Antarctica. Give us some time. Okay. So we exist in a wide range of environments. Different environments are going to put different pressures. So I think what we can say here is actually humans have been adapted to be somewhat flexible about this. The adaptation in terms of parental, especially paternal investment, male investment, is that it depends. We aren't locked in. There is variation. Depending upon the environment, different male approaches will be more or less successful. Males have the potential to operate in different ways. We've been selected for, if you will, flexibility. Part of this is undoubtedly due to our high degree of cognition. But, I mean, if you look at, elk. You can't change a male elk. You can't say dude, really. You know, instead of trying to have a harem of 20 females there, don't you think maybe you'd be a better elk male if you just focused on maybe two or three females? Look, the environment, you know, is a bit rough. I mean, couldn't you be, you know, it's like the elk is like, well, what are you saying? I don't get that. No, I'm just saying, you know, by this way you could spend time with the calves. What? You know, those things that are born. Oh, yeah, I've seen those around. You can't. Okay? That's genetic hardwiring in there. We're very flexible in our abilities. Okay. Life history factors. Brain size correlates with what we call life history factors. Now, what are life history factors? Life history factors are things like the age of weaning, the age of sexual maturity, gestation length, longevity. And we can look at these in all different species. Okay, you can apply this. We'll take a look at this, particularly in sort of related to us here. But what we tend to see, correlation, right? But if we look across species, species that have larger brains tend to stretch out their life history. Bigger, the greater the central nervous system investment, the longer the life history tends to be. Just to give you sort of a comparison here, for humans, about 1.4, 1.5 kilos of brain versus about 65 kilos in average of body. Your average monkey, rhesus or something like that. I mean, there's various monkeys come in all different shapes and sizes, but let's just say, you know, for a 7 kilo monkey, about 100 grams of brain. Baboons, the baboons got more, about 150 grams of brain, yeah, but about a 30 kilo body. I mean, baboons are, I'm sorry, contrary to the Lion King, it's like Simba, it's the great circle of life. Baboons just, it's like they're not a great sort of source of wisdom, right? Like, the baboon is not Yoda, okay? The baboon is like Darth Maul, just, I slice you up, haha. And I will now leave the Star Wars metaphors behind as we move back to this. Good. Gestation length for us here is quite long. Our average brain capacity is about 1,350 cubic centimeters. Comparison to other primates, that's huge. And if we compare to other primates in terms of our gestation length, we should gestate for 21 months, not the roughly 9 that we do. If we take a look at the sort of abilities that our infants have at birth and shortly after and compare this to other primates, to have infants that would be able to do the stuff that, say, even other just great apes are capable of doing at birth or shortly after birth, we should be gestating for about 21 months. Our babies have essentially about a year's worth of growth catch-up to do compared to the other primates. So I take a look at things that, say, my youngest son, Kestrel, can do now. He's about 11 months, 10 and a half months old. And it's like, yeah, this is the sort of stuff that typically, like, a chimpanzee baby would be doing after maybe a month. Moving around, crawling about, sticking things in the mouth, eating. Really tough. And what this means is we're basically giving birth prematurely. Not preemie births, what we call preemie births of like 6 or 7 months of gestation, but I mean, compared to other primates, we're premature. Our infants are pretty much helpless. And anyway, the visual system isn't even fully developed at birth, right? Our infants can see about maybe a foot, and it's blurry, it's fuzzy, it's distorted. They still really attend to facial information, but I mean, they're not really ready to come out. If you take a look at, a newborn apes, like chimpanzees, brain, it's about 200 cubic centimeters at birth. This is roughly half the size of an adult chimp's brain, about maybe 400, 450 cc's. So the newborn's brain only has to double from birth to adulthood. For humans, at birth, our brain's about 450 cubic centimeters on average. Remember, 1,350 cubic centimeters for the adult. So this is roughly about a third of the size of the adult. Both apes, chimpanzees, let's say here, and human brains actually reach the adult side fairly early in life. In humans, basically, by the time you're about age 5, you've pretty much got your adult size brain. Okay? 4 or 5. So this is stunningly rapid. I mean, and again, this is why... This is why the energy requirements for young children are huge.
I mean, where are they sticking the energy? So much of it is going into the central nervous system. I mean, they're just packing it in. When you look at this in terms of lactation for the females then, roughly about 90,000 calories to maintain a pregnancy, to gestate, huge. So I think about 90,000 there. Especially as you get into second and third trimesters, shoots up, right? Because what's happening then? CNS development is really picking up. And, of course, it's getting bigger overall. But then if you take a look at lactation, for the first sort of month or so, it's maybe an additional, few hundred calories a day for nursing the young. But then, I mean, this, you know, by about 8 months after birth, you're looking at maybe 700, you know, additional 700 calories a day in terms of nursing, 700,000 calories. So that doesn't seem like a lot. A couple of cheeseburgers. Yeah, but ancestrally, that was a lot. That's a huge amount of energy that you're sinking into the young. Even once the young stop exclusively nursing, most hunter-gatherers, non-industrialized, and people that practice various things like attachment parenting and long-term nursing, will continue to the mothers will continue to nurse the young for maybe up to 4 years, 4 or 5 years. Not exclusively. They start bringing actual solids in, often around 10 months, a year of age. And then those start coming in. But so, still, through the first year and a half, typically, females sinking a massive amount of energy into this. Once the kids start actually eating more and more on their own, right, they just become consuming machines. You know, you think about, good Lord, how can something this small eat that much? I mean, I remember at one point, you know, every, tried this, being the scientist that I am, it's like, I wonder how much yogurt my first son will eat in a sitting. He had a cup of yogurt. So at like 11 and a half months, he would like consume in a single sitting like a cup of yogurt. And then like 4 hours later, I could pack another cup of yogurt into him. It's like, holy smokes. I mean, I'm just burning through yogurt, you know. It's like, all right, let's vanilla. Let's try strawberry. It's like, oh, it's well, geez, you know, good probiotics there. Everything's ooh, regular. Hey, yogurt in, stuff out. But I mean, my point here is lots and lots of energy. My son's 6 and a half, my daughter's just turned 4, and basically, you know, like over the last year sort of thing, it's like, Grace is a lot smaller than my son, we should just be feeding her less. And I was going, no, actually, you know, I even know this from the pediatrician, and you should know this, she needs about as much food as my son who's older does. Why? At this point, he's expanded his brain to where it needs to get to as an adult. Anything he's doing now is just physical growth. Daughter's still laying down glial cells and everything else in there, so calories, calories, calories. Little kids can just, like, pack the calories in, and they'll need them. I mean, obviously, we go over this in our culture. We, you know, ends up obesity in kids, but I mean, they really do need a lot of food, and very particular foods. Anyway, so back to this. Okay, so as I said, both the chimpanzee and the human brains reach adult size fairly early on. The chimp brain only has to double in size. Ours has to triple. You might say, well, why don't we just double it? Good question. That would seem more efficient, wouldn't it? This would require that at birth, we gave birth to a child that has a brain size of almost 700 cubic centimeters, 675 cubic centimeters. That would quite literally make the head too big to go through the birth canal. Oops! Can't do that. Unless we evolved a zipper for, like, evolved cesarean. Won't come out, no problem. There we go! And a button. Not gonna work. Okay? Why? Why is this a problem? Because we started evolving bipedalism before our brains got bigger. Okay. Of the primates that are out there, we're the ones that have the largest birthing complications. Monkeys don't usually die in birth.
risk of complications during birth are low for the great apes, almost non-existent. It's the difference between the head size and the pelvis structure. All of the other primates are really quadrupeds. Their pelvis is wider. Proportionally, the birthing canal that has to get through the pelvis is bigger. And the hardest thing to get through the birth canal is the head. It's the most solid thing there. When shoulders and legs and everything just twists all around, it comes out easy. Okay? It's easy to get out. If you can't, okay, unless you got like breech birth or something coming backwards, well, that's tricky. But I mean, assuming it's head first, hardest thing to pass through is the head. And we're just at this range where you know, we've got the head sort of as small as possible, 450-odd cubic centimeters. Even sometimes it doesn't quite make it. It's a gamble. Birth for females is a risk. It's not a big risk for males, right? But it is a risk for females. So, it's the bipedal locomotion. He became bipedal first, then the brain size got larger. We're also one of the few species that really does menopause. There are some others, but we definitely see this. So usually between, you know, mid-40s, mid-50s, females' reproductive system shuts down, stops. One suggestion for this is called the grandmother hypothesis. In things like chimpanzees and most other primates, they'll just keep reproducing as long as they can up until pretty close to death. But we stop early. We stop reproducing, at least the females do, a long time before death. You're like, oh, wait a minute, in the past, didn't people only live like 30 years? Well, it's an average, right? Life expectancy is an average. If you survive childhood, if you survive birth, if you survive childhood, if you were male and survived like being a young, stupid male that wanted to fight everything in sight, and if you were a female that was able to make it through her first few births, odds are you'd live into your 60s or 70s. Not too different from now, in fact. So menopause, you know, mid-40s, 50s, would give women perhaps another 20 years. 15, 20 years, there's enough time to finish raising the last child and possibly even be assisting any of your daughters with the raising of their children. If you had daughters, say, earlier on, so children you had back when you were maybe in your 20s, now they're maybe having kids, so you can help with them, and you can make sure that any child you had there, say, in early 40s, is taken care of long enough to actually get out there and survive on his or her own. So grandmother hypothesis. Again, we don't see this in most species. Okay, now what about in terms of ancestral growth patterns here? Well, if we look at the size of craniums, which we can use to calculate the size of the brain, once our ancestors passed an adult brain size of about 770 cubic centimeters, if you want, round it to 800, roughly, we departed from an ape-like pattern of growth. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about modern apes, okay? And obviously, modern chimpanzees are not, you know, they are a modern species. There weren't chimpanzees 5 million years ago, okay? We didn't come from chimpanzees. Our Australopithecines and the precursors were probably morphologically fairly similar to modern chimpanzees, but they weren't chimpanzees, but still. Modern chimps are sort of the best we got as comparisons here, okay? So, as soon as our ancestors went beyond an adult brain size of about 770 to 800 cubic centimeters, our brain would have had to more than double from birth to adulthood. Okay, this is the point where we have to start sliding into the tripling range. So somewhere around here, once our ancestors passed about 770 cubic centimeters, this is where we start to get into the helplessness, the altricial nature of Homo sapiens, of modern Homo lines, young. So Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. Possibly Homo habilis as well. Okay? This is what I've been calling the premature birth. We should be gestating for like 21 months, but we don't. When did this happen? Well, late Homo habilis. Early Homo habilis definitely had a smaller brain, 650, but Homo habilis was around for, you know,
800,000 years, a million years, a long time. By the time you get into the late Homo habilis, about 800 cubic centimeters. So even the late Homo habilis there probably had helpless, somewhat helpless infants. Now that's going to lead to all kinds of differences in terms of, say, pair bonding, stuff that we were talking about before, mate choice issues. For Homo erectus, again, the brain size changes over time, but I mean, by at least the midpoint of Homo erectus, 900 cubic centimeters of brain, they're definitely in this. They definitely can't double the brain in size. They've got a lengthened developmental period here. The infants are helpless. They're not precocial in the sense of most of the primates. They're going to need a lot of investment here. If we look at this in terms of the life history or the developmental waypoints, we can see, let's do a comparison between, say, humans and modern chimpanzees. One of the things that's good to look at are teeth, tooth eruption. These show up in skulls that can be found, teeth fossilized very nicely. So this is useful in all kinds of ways here. In terms of the first molars, they tend to erupt at about age 6 in humans, about age 3 in chimpanzees. Second molars, 11 to 12 in humans, about age 7 in chimpanzees. And the third molars, or so-called wisdom teeth, 18 to 20 in humans, at about age 9 in chimpanzees. So it takes about twice as long for humans here to hit the same waypoints that chimps do. So we've got slower physical growth than our closest ape relatives. Holly Smith, Dr. Holly Smith at University of Michigan, has looked at this in archaeological findings and fossil records, and she's found that she can correlate growth rate, the overall growth rate of an organism, with that of tooth eruption. Looking at Australopithecines, their pattern of growth is very ape-like. Okay, so they basically, in Australopithecines, overall body growth and probably in terms of investment in offspring, very similar to modern chimpanzees. The early Homo erectus, those are the ones that were before that had less than the smaller, slightly smaller brains there. So early Homo erectus, like before 800,000 years ago, closer to a million years ago, their growth patterns were somewhat intermediate between apes and modern humans. So yes, I mean, some infant helplessness, but not as severe as it is in modern humans. The later Homo erectus, those that were in existence after 800,000 years ago, they have growth patterns essentially the same, tooth eruption patterns as well, as modern humans, and for that matter, Neanderthals. So Neanderthals as well would have had the same sort of issues necessitating some sort of male investment or multi-individual investment in the young. Okay? Female couldn't do it all by herself. Okay. Let's take a break here. So come on back in 10, and we will continue.